Hello and welcome to Bringing Design Closer. My name is Gerry Scullion and I'm a service designer and trainer based in Dublin City, Ireland. Bringing Design Closer is a podcast dedicated on shining the light on the complexities of embedding the designer's mindset within organisations. In this episode, I speak with Raven Kalyana, a puppeteer and human rights activist based in the UK and originally from the US. She studied at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, but what brings us here today is Raven's remarkable story of how she uses puppetry to campaign for public awareness and policy change around child abuse issues. She's written her own autobiographical play called Hooray for Hollywood on surviving and escaping human trafficking as a child, which she has since made into a film. Raven is the founder of Outspiral, an organisation using puppetry to provide training for charities, counsellors, law enforcement and support techniques. She also delivers puppet-based workshops and trauma recovery for survivors and child victims. She facilitates societal healing through performances of her play, Love Versus Trauma, which follows with a discussion on the personal and social effects of trauma and how we might visualize new possibilities for the future. Now, I would like to point out that this episode contains information that may be triggering for some people and covers off topics such as abuse and the effects of trauma. Let's get straight into the episode. Raven Kalyana, a very warm welcome to Bringing Design Closer. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Nice to speak with you.
Raven, let's start off. How do you describe what you do?
Well, I would say that I write and produce plays and films that utilize puppetry, and most of them are for adults or for teens. I also create workshops also for mostly adults and teens, and I do a lot of education on trauma recovery and also on human trafficking and child sexual exploitation issues, a lot of awareness raising.
Excellent. It's such an interesting topic, and we're going to get into the nuts and bolts today of understanding trauma and its complexity. So let's start off first, and we'll talk a little bit more around how you understand trauma. How would you describe it?
Well, trauma is something that your body perceives as an extreme violation or life-threatening. And in animals, if they go through, you know, say if some a hawk comes after a rabbit or something like that, the rabbit will either run, or if it's cornered, it may fight back. And if it if that doesn't work, it might go into a state called freeze, where it just sort of shuts down and pretends to be dead. But with humans, because we are social animals and because we are so dependent on each other for everything in life, you know, our food, our shelter, and children even more so, even have fewer choices, we will tend more to go into the freeze state than the fight or the flight. So for instance, a child isn't going to fight, you know, physically attack its parents if its needs aren't being met. And it won't, you know, it won't necessarily run away, because if it goes outside and tries to, you know, if the child tries to live by his or herself in the streets, it will probably die. So, so because children are so dependent on adults for survival, most often they just go into a freeze state. But that's also true in so many social situations as well. Like if someone is being bullied in their workplace, they may feel that they don't have any options. They can't, like, you know, punch the person who's you know, ridiculing them or sabotaging them. They can't, run outside into the street, or else they, you know, probably won't be, you know, allowed to come back. And, so most often the response is to freeze. So people just shut down emotionally. A lot of the sort of physical, there's a lot of physical symptoms that are associated with that. So in humans, the freeze response is associated with a lot of shame, with a lot of post-traumatic stress symptoms, with a lot of different sorts of physical symptoms, because we're not expressing that big jolt of adrenaline. We're just we're it's just sitting in our bodies. We're not doing anything with it. And so it also leads to a feelings of disempowerment and also a lack of vision for the future, a lack of hope in the vision in the future, and a lack of connection with other people. Because people, when they shut down, they start to get this feeling like they're inside of a fish tank or something. That's a really common description of how it feels when you've been through when you've been through trauma and you're experiencing post-traumatic stress. You feel like you can't connect with other people. You feel really withdrawn.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually, in this space of trauma, like it's something that I actually experienced and something I researched when I was living in Australia, and it was hugely profound. But when I noticed that when I was working with the NGOs, and some of the NGOs were supporting children as young as who'd been through abuse at 6 months, all the way up to adults, and you could see that the abuse has affected their entire life. It's something they've carried on their shoulders, and it affects how they see the world and their ability to connect with other people and the ability to manage their own emotional states. And I remember there was one really profound story as regards there was a male who had been abused throughout his childhood, and in his adult life he ended up having two baby girls. He had twins at a very young age, maybe in his early 20s, but because he was abused, he had this whole belief system that, you know, you've been abused, you will abuse. Ooh. And as a result, his whole marriage broke down because he was unable to support the family, unable to like be present with the family. Mm. And it cascaded into eventually his two girls were then adults. And it was only when he sought and he sought, therapy and support for his abuse that he realized that wasn't true. He just wasn't able to connect because for that fear that he was going to become the abuser, which is an absolute myth. Like when you look at the statistics, that is a myth. It's something that I often see being misconstrued and misportrayed online in Twitter streams. And it's like, that is not necessarily true.
True.
So the next question I want to ask you is about, like, now that we've kind of spoken a little bit more around trauma, how have you seen governments typically address the support of victims who are suffering from trauma?
Well, the model that I see is more pathologizing trauma responses, like medicalizing it, instead of basically shaming the person who has suffered and not looking at the crimes at all. So not holding the criminals responsible in any way, but instead focusing on the survivors, physical responses to the effects of the abuse, and trying to shame them for that, so depression, or maybe they have addictions, or maybe they chronically under earn money, or things like that, because of low self-esteem. So those are ways that society and governments sort of shame people and say, oh, well, here's some, maybe we can have, give you some benefits or something. But at the same time, there's no what gets cut in, especially in austerity times, what gets cut is any sort of therapies, any kind of free counseling, especially person-centered counseling, where the person might be able to actually just, actually heal, like literally heal from what they've been through, instead of like, oh, well, here's some antidepressants to hide the symptoms, instead of here's some counseling so that you won't have to deal with those symptoms anymore in your life, because you can actually heal the backlog of emotions, the backlog. If there's enough feeling of witnessing and processing and sort of replacing the love and care and tenderness that was, taken from the person during the, situation of abuse, if that's, replaced, then they heal. And it is a relatively simple process, but it's people are most often given drugs and or behavioral therapies and things like that, instead of, how about if we just listen how about if we just make some space in our society for people to feel their feelings? And how about if we accept that, yes, if you've been through something terrible, you're not going to necessarily feel very good about it. And then on the other side of that is, you know, not holding perpetrators to account. So it's a lot of what we see is that people might go through, they might have a trauma history, you know, in their childhood, or they might, you know, get into abusive relationships in adulthood because they think, oh, that's all I'm worth, you know?
Yeah, and absolutely. One of the things, I guess, it's just to build on that topic, was the stigma and the taboo that goes around abuse,
yes,
and especially child sexual abuse in society. It was one of the quickest ways for me to shut a dinner party up by telling people that I was researching at the time, because it was such one of those topics that I couldn't turn off from. It was like it was something that I was always on. I was always listening and I was always focusing on. But there was this huge taboo around talking about abuse.
Yes, yes.
And there's a responsibility from society there to really acknowledge its presence in the room. And it was something that I really struggled with, that, you know, I'd speak to people in the pub, it would silence them, and they were like, oh, he's mentioned,
we're here to escape talking. That subject matter.
Yeah, let's just talk about the beer. Yes. You know, and I was like, no, like, I think this needs to be addressed.
Yes.
And there's stuff there. So I think, you know, how do we get around that?
Well, basically, you know, we don't have to escape from reality. We have to make reality better. And to do that, we have to face reality and talk about it. So all the silencing, we need to get past that. We need to talk with each other. And, you know, what happens when people start to share about past trauma is you start to get things like the Me Too movement, where people are like, oh, actually, I thought I was all alone. I thought I was the only person who suffered that. And then, oh, actually, here's thousands upon thousands of thousands of people who have suffered the same thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, just like in if you want better kind of better rights in a workplace, you might have to unionize. And to get past that, you need to talk with other people there. But it's the same time, you know, same thing with people who have suffered abuse, is that people need to talk. They need to find each other. They need to say, actually, this is unacceptable. You know, there's no effective response to child sexual abuse. Like, there's no effective legal response. So,
yeah.
I went to a police conference a few years ago and presented there, and it was really, really fascinating, but really disheartening. Because let me see if I can remember. I think that they were out of,
this is in the UK.
This was in Norfolk. So it was the Norfolk Regional Conference, and so they were saying that out of the number of, I think they said that only 5% of children who reported any kind of sexual abuse to adults, only 5% of them actually get taken to a police station to make an actual police report.
Yeah.
And then out of that 5%, and of course, you know, most children aren't going to be talking about it anyway, because trauma shuts down language. So people who suffer trauma, they don't even store the trauma experience the same way you store other types of memory. So it's not stored in a narrative form where you can say, oh, well, I went to the shop and then I didn't look both ways far across the street, and then, oh, here comes a bus. You know, you can't say it in a narrative way, because what you actually remember is I saw the sky and a bird flying, and then I saw, you know, red, and your brain records it as the initial sensory perceptions, like the individual senses. So smell, sight, meaning, and sound, it all gets recorded in its original form and not in a narrative form. So that's how it comes back as well. And that's how children can't, you know, it's very difficult for them to articulate it. Yes, to put, because they don't have any words for that. They might say, oh, I saw a bird. Like,
yeah,
you know, I saw red, you know, they can only talk about the individual bits and pieces and not the whole of it. So it's hard to make sense of it as an adult. However, in their play, they will reenact it, and you can see it in their play. You can see it in their dioramas with their toys. You can see how they behave with other children. They will repeat this, and that's how they can tell. And so in terms of the statistics, so, you know, 5% of children who report to adults in their life, only 5% of all of the children who report manage to put into words that something's wrong. Only 5% of them actually get into police reports. And out of that 5%, only 7% actually get
to court.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then it's a similar even smaller
statistic that I heard before.
Yeah. It's really unfortunate. And then if a perpetrator actually gets a sentence, I think it's only in like 24% or something of the cases, they'll actually get a custodial sentence. So most of the time it's just sort of like, oh, you really shouldn't do that. Maybe here's a fine or something. And most of the time they're just kind of released back into the community without any support, without any, like, nothing around them to help them change their behavior. It's just, there's really very few consequences for someone perpetrating against children.
Totally. And like, when you look at the judicial process and the prosecution process, it's kind of framed in something that was designed 200, 300 years ago in many cases.
Yes, I found a really good quote about that. And that is by Judith Herman. And she said that the judicial system is designed to protect men against the greater power of the state, but it not to protect women and children against the greater power of men.
Wow.
So I thought that might fit your experience in Australia.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, the whole kind of, you know, the defense, cross-examining a child on the stand and asking them, you know, stuff that fits with that model of prosecution, like asking them about, you know, sight, you know, what did you see and what did you smell and, you know, what time is it? Like for a child,
what time is it? They might not even be able to tell time.
They don't even know what time is. Like, you know, my little girl, like she wakes up and she's 3.5 and she'll wake up and she goes, is it dinner time?
Oh.
And I'm like, no, you've just woken up. It's breakfast. You know, and like, you know, we're going to have our breakfast now. Like sometimes she gets confused with the time. And like, it's something as basic as that. So asking a child what time of day it was when they don't have those models is just, it's just crazy, crazy, kind of a crazy model to work with.
Can you give some other examples of what kinds of questions were asked of children on the witness stand?
I remember the wallpaper was one, like, tell us what the wallpaper was like, you know, when this happened. And they were, you know, as you said, it's very difficult for someone, even for me, like, but for someone who's in that state of freezing or, you know, flight, it's, you're not going to remember like the pattern that was on the wallpaper.
No. Did you feel like the lawyers were bullying the children, or what was your impression?
I think that's definitely, you know, a shared understanding and a shared perspective from many people who work in that space globally, that there is a sense that the defense are barraging, you know, these young children, and it needs to change. It's just not fair. And that model of is just very old school.
Yeah.
Which brings us into a really good, like, there's some really great examples of the new way of thinking and a new way of approaching this to support those children who've been through that sort of awful scenario, an awful time in their life. And you've actually got a really great example of a trauma center in Boston.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Yeah, I was working on a documentary, and unfortunately it never was finished, sadly. But I would like to pick up and do a different documentary and just interview the same people because it was some fantastic, insightful interviews and really inspiring work in terms of child advocacy. So there's the trauma center in Boston has a section that's called the Child Advocacy Center, and they've got this sort of, you know, gentle playroom, fun colors on the wall, and, you know, very, you know, sweet people leading the families in. And then when the what they'll do is they've designed a room with a two-way mirror so that the child can sit with a big pad of paper, toys all around, crayons, paints, finger paints, you know, whatever, and one interviewer who is trained in child sensitivity to interview the child. And the way it works is that the interviewer has a little headset on, and on the other side of the two-way mirror are police, you know, medical professionals, lawyers, social workers, everybody who's going to need to be involved in the case. So in that way, the child can just tell their story once to one person in a safe feeling environment. They can stop anytime. They can take a break. You know, there isn't any, you know, pressure or bullying. It's just someone who's, you know, very gentle. You know, I think there's even like a sand tray, so the child can make little dioramas to actually show what happened to them instead of actually using words if words are too hard. And in that way, everyone who's involved in the case, you know, can ask the questions through the interviewer, and then the interviewer interprets it in a way that's non-threatening to the child. And in that way, they videotape the whole thing, and then they can use that whole session, the whole interview session, they can use that in the court in place of the child actually going to the court.
Yeah, which is amazing. They're trying to do that in New South Wales and Australia.
They were trialing
when I was leaving. And it's just, you know, it saves the child and the family that whole traumatic experience of having to go to court, and just going to court alone to be in the same room as you know, the defendant, or, you know, the person who committed the crime.
Yes, imagine that as a child.
Yeah, you're putting them back in the same space. Like they do remote witness rooms in Australia. I don't know if they do that in America or the UK. I'm pretty sure they do in the UK. But too often the remote rooms are in the courthouse. So I've seen instances where, you know, I know where the rooms were in this courthouse, and you know, I was sitting behind the parent who committed, or, you know, reportedly committed the crime. And whenever the judge, you know, the magistrate called time on the session, the child had been given a piece of paper to look at, a photo, and at the end of the day, they said, okay, we just need to get the paper back. And within about 20 seconds, the paper was back in the courtroom. So now you know the time it took for the piece of paper to get from A to B is 20 seconds. You know that the child is around somewhere. And you could see the parent's head swiveling around.
No.
And I'm like, oh man, this is just like, so the whole system, you know, is broken. And it's very, very difficult. I'm really enjoying this conversation. But let's talk a little bit more around your story, Raven. Like, you've got a really interesting how you managed to get to this point in your career.
Well, I'm interested both in education on trauma recovery, and also I'm interested in puppetry as well. The reason I do so much public education work is that I was trafficked as a child by my parents. It was they were involved with a pedophile ring in my neighborhood, and you know, just, you know, horrible stuff happened when I was a child. It's like loads of like I was trafficked to different studios around the US. You know, some of them were nearby, some of them were like, you know, thousands of miles away, some of them were actually across international borders. And that was for the production of child sexual exploitation materials. So, you know, other people call it, you know, used to call it child pornography, if you haven't heard that term. But child sexual exploitation materials kind of tells it, you know, makes it a little clearer what that actually is.
Absolutely.
These are not actors. These are it's actually just a like crime scene footage of children being sexually assaulted and sometimes tortured, sometimes murdered. It's very, very serious crimes. And I escaped when I was because my parents were involved, they were kind of like middle class ish. So they wanted me to get, you know, high marks in school to sort of cover for them. And, you know, so people wouldn't ask questions like, oh, well, she's doing well in school. There couldn't possibly be anything wrong at home. I guess we'll just ignore those bruises all over her body. You know, so people, you know, wouldn't inquire because I was doing well academically. But fortunately, that also ended up being to my benefit as well, because a teacher, you know, felt, you know, invested in me and cared about me and was worried about me and did ask me about, you know, what was happening at home. And when I told her, she was really scared for me. And she actually helped me make a plan to try to stabilize this very chaotic and life-threatening situation that I was going through at home. And also like a long-term plan just to get away from my parents and their whole, you know, crime associates. You know, it was quite a big organized crime network that they were involved with. So, so basically, the plan was to negotiate with my teachers about my absences, because my marks were high, but I was losing a lot of hours at school because of injuries or because I was being taken out of state by my father, drugged and taken away. So staying in school was kind of how I managed to get on to university. And at university, I kind of created a new support system for myself.
Yeah.
And that enabled me enough kind of, because it sort of replaced the fake support system I had, the support system that wasn't a support system, you know, my family, with one that was actually real and actually people who cared about me and, you know, wanted me to have a good future and, you know, wanted to treat me well. And so I was able to cut off contact with my abusers. And after a lot of, I mean, they continued to harass me for a few years, and it took a while, you know, until I was actually completely safe from them. But it definitely made a big difference to in my life and in terms of my safety and sense of well-being to actually, you know, not be in danger anymore.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's an incredible story.
Yes, and one thing that was great is that I actually found a lot of other survivors who were interested in healing and not interested in this whole, pathologizing survivors, but actually interested in actually working with the trauma material, processing it, letting it go, and also looking at society, what's happening in society and how can we change it. So they were friends who were interested in activism work. So that was quite inspiring and quite an early influence for me.
It's such an incredibly shocking story, Raven, and one where you've shown so much resilience. So tell me, how did puppetry come into your life and how did you discover its power as a support tool?
So after quite, I was at university, I earned a degree, and after university, I moved to San Francisco and got hired at a company that makes hand puppets. And at that, I know, it was fantastic. My life changed exponentially for the better the day I walked in their door. It was really amazing. But actually by that point, I was actually, you know, instead of my, because I'd gone through this healing process where I wasn't running away from my pain, but actually, witnessing my pain and healing my pain, then I actually, my baseline mood from day to day, instead of being all, extremely, uncomfortable and, afraid or upset, or it transformed into being mostly happiness, mostly joy, mostly satisfaction, curiosity. And so, getting hired at Folk Monas Puppets was a great, sort of juncture for that, because I was in quite a good place in my life when I was first hired by them. And it was kind of like a bit of a replacement family for me. Like I just love them so much. I can't express how much I love those people. And they really took very good care of their employees, like very, it was like profit sharing set up, and people just never wanted to leave. They're the same people that were there when I was hired in the 90s are still there today.
Wow, that's amazing.
People just don't want to leave. They really are a family. Yeah, and it is run by a family, but actually the people the people who've been hired there, they just never want to leave. So they have become family to each other as well. It's a remarkable place. And the puppetry, the puppetry community globally tends to be quite an amazing thing as well. People really look out for each other and really care about each other, and like, oh, hey, I got offered this work, but I can't do it because I'll be out of town. Maybe you would like to do this. Like, what other industry does that happen in? And people will, oh, here's a puppet festival, but you'd like to go, but where will you stay? Like, oh, you can stay at this puppeteer's studio. Oh, you can stay at this puppeteer's home. People will open their homes to strangers who are also puppeteers. And it's just like an amazing community where people really actually nurture each other and care about each other and, mentor each other. It's really wonderful. And so, at Folk Monas Puppets, I got the idea while I was working there. I mean, because I also saw how much adults love puppets, and also Folk Monas Puppets donates a lot of puppets to charity. Like, for instance, they would donate them to refugee camps where the kids are may have lost their parents and whole families, and so the puppets really helped the kids kind of come back into the present a bit. And so it was just so inspiring to see the potential for puppetry. And so I got the idea, oh, right, I feel like words, just words, aren't the right medium for my story. I feel like if I created a show using puppets, then it would be easier for me to work with that material. Because I wanted to use my story for public education work, and then it would also be much easier for audiences as well to be able to engage with that subject matter, because if you see an actor on a stage, there's already this sort of kind of cynicism comes down. You switch into this kind of intellectual mode when you see an actor, like, oh, do they have to hire an actor who's in their 30s to play someone who's 16 or whatever?
Yeah.
there's all this kind of initial, like, oh, God. We've seen it all before. So, but puppets we haven't seen. So it turned out to be a very, very good medium for doing that. And in 2007, I moved to England and got my master's at Central School of Speech and Drama. And that was where I put together my show, Hooray for Hollywood. And it was an amazing, amazing thing. I think my poor tutors, I don't know what they thought.
Yeah.
At first they were like, don't do that. I mean, some of them, I think because they didn't realize it was my own life story. So they were just so afraid that I was, have you done your research on this subject? They're like, oh, yeah, I've done lots of research. But I think
I was going to say, what is it you think the power of puppetry is as regards, like,
well, It is like this one step removed. It's the same as when you're a child, you've gone through something terrible in your day, and then you work it out with your toys. So it's like you can, you know, use the dinosaur toy and the truck toy. You know, the dinosaur got run over by the truck on the playground today, but now the dinosaur is going to fight back, and the dinosaur is going to, you know, bite the truck. You know, so it's like the kids can work out the dynamics that have happened to them in the day. They work it out through their play. You know, I think yeah. Adults do that mostly in their dreams as well. Like it's something, a way you sort of work out, you know, what's happened to you. But most of us don't even remember our dreams. But children actually do it in three dimensions. You know, but adults, we're not really given very much opportunity, or, you know, if we are doing something that's three dimensional, sometimes it's ridiculed. You know, like there isn't like, you know, like, oh, you know, like a play cafe for adults. If somebody wants to do that, I'm for it.
Yeah, there's something in it. But I'll go. I'll be the first one there. But looking at storytelling, you know, by putting a puppet into the sort of situation, you're shifting the focus onto another thing.
Yes.
And it's easier to convey the story without getting too caught up in the complexity, the emotions that are attached to the story.
It's a way to sort of explore it in a tentative way where you're like, oh, this is just pretend. You know, you can start out, this is just pretend, and sort of you can kind of work up to it. You know, it doesn't have to be this, you know, shocking, horrible thing. You can kind of, you can slowly ease into it because you're, you know, you're playing with a thing that you know is inanimate, and yet your own mind is bringing it to life as you're being invited to play. But I say it's like adults are kind of discouraged from using their imagination. I mean, even during teenagehood, it seems like, you know, oh, you know, we're so discouraged from playing. But, you know, that is how humans actually learn to do things differently, and how they start to envision a different way forward. And so I think puppets are a really powerful medium.
Yeah, I know Adam Lawrence and Marcus Hormez from Workplay Experience in Germany. They run a fantastic workshop facilitation course around theatrical sort of play out experiences for designers to take them out of that comfort zone. And, you know, I think puppetry is an extension of that type of thinking. Have you seen puppetry, being used potentially in the examination process for children as they go to deliver their evidence, in terms of, you know, co-facilitation of the story through puppetry?
I mean, I didn't see that specifically at the trauma center in Boston. And that was kind of my only experience, you know, directly dealing with, you know, a child advocacy center like that. But a lot of play therapists, you know, that's kind of a standard, is to have some puppets in the room, because the kids find it much easier to, you know, for instance, even just tell something to a puppet than to an adult, you know. And then they, you know, they could also, you know, use the cuddle with the puppet, you know, it's a comfort as they're talking about something that's scary. And then also they can, you know, work out the different dynamics, like, you know, here's the rooster and here's the lion. And, you know, it's like, you know, one of them represents them, one of them represents whoever has hurt them. And they can kind of, you know, work out what the dynamic is, and actually demonstrate it to the counselor, but without them necessarily without the child being necessarily consciously aware that that's what they're showing to the counselor. But anybody who's trained in that, you know, anybody who's trained in play therapy can definitely, you know, see what the dynamics are in the situation that is, you know, that is bothering the child.
Yeah. Raven, we're coming towards the end of the episode. It's been really, really amazing to speak with you, and, you know, for you to share your story as well. If people want to reach out to you and follow you, like, how might they be able to get in touch and do that?
Well, right now I'm touring a new show that's called Love Versus Trauma. And what I do is follow it with a post-show discussion that is on trauma. And I am bringing that around to the UK. People can find me on my website, and that's just ravenkalyana.com. Maybe you can spell it out somewhere.
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yes. And basically, I'm trying to invite people to visualize a different future. So, in the same way that a child has, a traumatized child has trouble visualizing their own future, adults mm-hmm. have that as well. So, if anybody, even if people don't realize that so many things are traumatic, like, you know, verbal abuse, if somebody called you stupid mm-hmm. the whole time you're growing up, or was never encouraging, anything that denies your inner self, that's traumatic. If anything that feels like annihilation of who you are inside is traumatic. And I think that is a universal experience. And I think that if we can work towards helping people visualize a future that works better, I think that making spaces for those conversations can really help us as a species going forward.
Again, Raven, it was fantastic to speak with you today. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you'd like to be part of the conversation or community, hop on over to thisishcd.com, where you can join the Slack community and help shape future episodes and connect with other designers around the world, or join the HCD newsletter where you can win books and get updates. Subscribe to our content on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and listen to any of our other podcasts, such as Getting Started in Design, Bringing Design Closer with myself, Jerry Scullion, or Power of 10 with Andy Pullane, or Decoding Culture with Dr. John Curran, Prod Pod with Adrian Tan, and Ethnopod with Jay Hasbrook. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.